what we have now is an issue that is going to come to the absolute forefront when the mark of the beast is imposed. And it's the issue of Sabbath observance and reasonable accommodation by employers. Our speaker for this afternoon is Brother Jonathan Cherney, Esquire, who is an attorney and a CPA. His law practice focuses on helping those who have suffered religious discrimination in the workplace, as well as estate planning. Mr. Cherney was one of the attorneys that represented Gerald Groff in his recent U.S. Supreme Court case against the U.S. Postal Service. Mr. Cherney also serves as the Associate Director of American Christian Ministries, a ministry dedicated to spreading the Three Angels' messages without compromise. Please join me in welcoming Brother Cherney. We're delighted he's with us, and I thank God that he's given people these gifts to fight the good fight of faith in the Supreme Court of the United States. Brother Jonathan, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. How many of you here have heard of American Cassette Ministries? Oh, good. So we know what cassettes are. Well, we don't have cassettes anymore, and so we kind of had to rename ourselves. And American CD Ministries, that would have gone out of style pretty quick. So we're American Christian Ministries. So if you don't have our app, I encourage you to download the app. There's some wonderful godly presentations on there going back to the 1970s when no one was recording our Adventist evangelists. And so you can go on there and listen to them. We have over 8,000 sermons, and we continue to add new stuff every week as well. So it's not just old stuff, but the old stuff is good stuff. So I enjoy going back and listening to some people that preached before I was alive. So I encourage you to go and check it out if you haven't. So I am an attorney. I do religious discrimination work. That wasn't what I originally thought I was going to do in law school. I went to law school having just passed the CPA exam, thinking that I was going to do tax law, and glad I didn't enter that boring career of the tax code. And God had different plans, and I'm thankful for that. And by His grace, I was able to work on a case that went up to the Supreme Court earlier this year in April, which we received a favorable decision about in June 30th of this year. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But before I get started, a lot of people have asked me, and I have, I've talked some about this case at other churches and places, and some people come up to me and, hey, why are you representing a Sunday keeper? And I had this one lady, and God bless her, she was convinced that I was bringing in the Sunday law. And so she was talking to me, giving me this hard time. We had a nice conversation. And so people ask me, why are you representing a Sunday keeper? And, it kind of made me think about a couple years ago, I had the same questions asked to me. People asked me, why are you representing anti-vaxxers? Why are you representing people that won't get vaccinated? You know, that we all need to help others or for the common good or whatever. And so, I've gotten these questions a lot, and it made me think, do we just stand up for our own beliefs? Is that what religious liberty is? Liberty for me, but not for thee? Or do we stand up for all beliefs? I had a lady a couple years ago call me in tears, the sole provider of her home, about to lose her job because she would not get the COVID vaccine. And she was crying to me and telling me about how her pastor told her he wouldn't write a letter for her. He wasn't going to help her. And I know that this was happening not just to her, but to many people. In all churches, and sadly in our own church, where pastors were refusing, I heard pastors from the pulpit saying, I'm not going to write any letters, so don't even ask me, telling that to the congregation. and conferences telling their pastors not to write religious liberty letters. Not that you needed them, but people, HR people, employers, and employees were confused thinking that they did. And not giving people hope, not helping people. Are we not called to help people? Is that not what a pastor is supposed to be as a shepherd? Many people didn't help. Many religious liberty attorneys shied away because it was too political or it wasn't scientific. Well, I have news for you. The day is not far from us when keeping Sunday will be scientific. Right? And we will have to make a decision. Are we going to follow the science or are we going to follow the Bible? And so even though it's not my belief, wearing a yarmulke is not my belief, does that mean it's not a religious liberty issue? I don't practice animal sacrifices or wear a hijab. Does that mean those aren't religious liberty issues for other people? And so when we start to say, because the church and people start to say, well, that's not a religious liberty issue, right? When we start to say what is or isn't a religious liberty issue, are we not stepping between man and God? Who am I to tell you what a religious liberty issue is for you? Who am I to tell you that that is not what God has convicted you to do? And so when we start to say to others that this isn't a religious liberty issue, we are stepping between man and his maker. And that is wrong. There's a quote here from Ellen White. It says, the banner of truth and religious liberty held aloft by the founders of the gospel church and by God's witnesses during the centuries that have passed since then has in this last conflict been committed to our hands. Did you guys know that the banner of religious liberty has been committed to your hands? To the hands of the Seventh-day Adventist Church? This is a banner that we are supposed to be holding. And what happens when you let a banner down? What happens when you let a banner down? Do men not retreat? Does the enemy not advance? If we let the banner of religious liberty down, the enemy will gain ground. And so we have to hold this banner aloft. We have to hold it high. When we wave it high, it encourages others. It strengthens the faith of others. Yes, we need to be holding this banner high. So another quote from Manuscript 30, 1889. It says, our own land is to become a battlefield on which is to be carried on the struggle for religious liberty to worship God according to the dictates of our own conscience. Ellen White specifically tells us that this land, America, will become a battlefield of religious liberty. And if we aren't practicing that now for people who maybe they believe differently than us, if we aren't lifting up, you know what they say, a rising tide lifts all ships, right? If we aren't lifting up religious liberty in this land, then we are losing the battle. The battle is not just for Adventists. The battle is for people of all faith, regardless of their religion. Quote goes on to say, then can we not discern the work of the enemy in keeping men asleep who ought to be awake, whose influence shall not be neutral, but wholly and entirely on the Lord's side? Shall men cry peace and safety now when sudden destruction is coming upon the world, when God's wrath shall be poured out? Friends, we are in a battle between good and evil. And this battle centers around religious liberty. And we know the final conflict will be regarding religious liberty. And so we must hold this banner high. And why has God committed it into our hands? I believe for a couple reasons why he's given this to Seventh-day Adventists. One is because we understand Bible prophecy. No other denomination understands Bible prophecy as does the Seventh-day Adventists. We know that this final crisis will be about the freedom that men have to worship God. We also believe that everyone should be able to worship God according to the dictates of his or her own conscience. And so, like Brother Zirkle pointed out, you know, the Puritans, they were all about freedom for them, right? And the Church of England was all about freedom for them. And all the religious entities of the past before the United States of America was about freedom for themselves. Religious freedom was won by military conquests. And then you lorded it over your subjects so that you could keep serving your gods. But that's not how America was built. And we as Adventists believe that everyone should be freely able to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. Whether that means worshiping on Sunday or worshiping on the Sabbath. Whether that means getting a vaccine or not getting a vaccine. Whatever that means, we should not stand in the way between man and his maker. We also know, as Adventists, that a nation flourishes when it gives religious freedom. And we know that this country will fall and go down when it takes away religious freedom. It is only by religious freedom that we have God's blessing and that we can thrive and have peace with one another. And so that is why I believe this banner was passed on to us. And I hope and pray that you all are doing all you can to raise that banner high. And it doesn't mean you have to become an attorney. I hope you don't. But we can do other things, right? We can share the truth. We can speak up. We can talk to our local representatives. There's many things that we can do to advance religious liberty. So, Mr. Groff, so that kind of is why I represent people of all faiths. I've represented Muslims, Sikhs, Jews, Baptists, non-denominational Christians, and of course, many Seventh-day Adventists. In this case, Mr. Groff, I'd like you to meet him. He's in the middle there. He is an evangelical Christian, and he believes that the fourth commandment requires him to keep the Lord's Day holy, which he understands to be Sunday. And he's convicted that he should not work on Sunday. And all was fine because the post office doesn't deliver mail on Sunday, right? And so he was having a good career working as a rural route carrier, bringing you your mail. Thanks to consumerism and all of you guys that buy Amazon packages and wanting Sunday delivery, the post office struck a deal with Amazon and said, you know, we'll deliver your packages on Sunday. And so we don't get our regular mail on Sunday, but we get Amazon packages on Sunday. And so he was working at a rather large post office facility there, and they wanted him to start driving on Sundays. And he told the postmaster, look, I'm really sorry, but, I observe that day as a day of rest and worship, and I can't do that. And the postmaster at first said, okay. And so when his turn would come up on Sunday, they would skip over his name and call the next guy on the list. Well, after about, a couple months, a year of doing this, the postmaster decided, you know what, I'm not going to do that anymore for you. You know, you better come in. And so they started writing him up, and he realized that this wasn't a good situation. And he found a smaller post office nearby that was more rural, and they didn't deliver packages on Sundays. And so he transferred over to that station. So he was driving there for a while, but, well, consumerism has come to country living, right? So all you guys living in the country, still buying on Amazon. And that post office eventually was required to start making Sunday deliveries. And so, again, he told his postmaster, look, I can't do that. And they found a coworker who she said, hey, if you take my weekly day off, I'll drive all your Sundays. And so that worked for a while until I think she got sick or something, but it ended up not working out anymore, and they were starting to make him drive again on Sundays, which he refused to do. And so then they started disciplining him, giving him a verbal warning, and then a written warning, and then a 7-day suspension, and then a 14-day suspension. And so he ended up filing a complaint with the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and ended up resigning from his job. And so he found a local attorney who then referred him to this nonprofit organization that handles First Amendment sort of cases, and they had heard about the Church State Council, which is the Religious Liberty Division of the Pacific Union, and who I partner with and do a lot of work with. Alan Reinach heads up that office. And so they brought us in on the case because we do a lot of Sabbath accommodation cases. And so that's how we ended up getting involved in the case. And so what the law says is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So this wasn't a First Amendment case, so to speak, the free exercise of religion. But this was brought under Title VII, which is a statute. It's a statutory law that Congress made in 1964. And it says that it shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or to discharge any individual or otherwise to discriminate against any individual with respect to his compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment because of such individuals, and they have, you know, race, sex, gender, all that, or religion is in there. And so it's unlawful for an employer to discriminate against employees on the basis of religion. And not just if you're working there, but if you're an applicant, if you go and apply. In fact, I'm starting a trial on Monday. Please pray for me. Seventh-day Adventist applied to work for Charter Communications, you know, Spectrum Internet Cable Services, to be a technician. And they refused to hire him because he won't work on Saturdays. And, well, you know, that's a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. It says that you cannot refuse to hire somebody because of their religious belief. Now, some people question, well, that doesn't make sense, right? They need someone to do the work on Saturday. How can you force them to do that? Well, in this case with Charter, they have three schedules: Sunday to Thursday, Monday to Friday, or Tuesday to Saturday. And they have the discretion to put you in any schedule they want. So there's at least one schedule that will for sure accommodate my client, which is Sunday to Thursday, right? And they could have easily hired him and given him that schedule. Also Monday to Friday, however, during times of the year, you know, that would go into the Sabbath hours. But then obviously they're trying to say that, you know, we only had Tuesday to Thursday schedules available. And so what's interesting, though, is they hired 9 employees at that same time, three of which they gave Sunday to Thursday schedules. So I think we have a pretty good case, but never know how a jury's going to go or trier of fact, so keep me in prayer. But we have the right to practice our religious belief, and the law says so, short of an undue hardship. So it does say that the term religion, it defines, includes all aspects of religious observance and practice, as well as belief, unless an employer demonstrates that he or it is unable to reasonably accommodate an employee's or prospective employee's religious observance or practice without undue hardship on the conduct of the employer's business. And so the law says you have to accommodate unless it would be an undue hardship on the business. And so we're arguing on Monday that they could have easily given him a Sunday to Thursday position and it would not have been an undue hardship. And we argued in our case with the post office that the post office could have easily accommodated him. They have part-time flex employees that they call in when people are sick or on vacation to drive routes for them. The post office that he transferred to is not a what Amazon calls a mandatory delivery office. So they're not required to deliver on Sunday. It's preferred that they do, but the postmaster has discretion not to do Sunday deliveries if need be for the operations of that office. And so the post office was under no obligation with their contract with Amazon, and so they could have accommodated Mr. Groff short of undue hardship. And so the law says that you and I, Seventh-day Adventists, we can be accommodated at our place of employment unless the employer can prove, and it's their burden of proof, to prove that it would be an undue hardship on the conduct of the employer's business. And so remember that term, undue hardship. Now, that was for the Groff case against the post office. The whole issue in the case was, what does the term undue hardship mean? Well, unfortunately, back in 1977, there was a case called Trans World Airlines versus Hardison. And Larry Hardison, he was an employee of Trans World Airline. You guys might remember that airline. It's now long since defunct. But Hardison, he was a member of the Worldwide Church of God. And he refused to work on Saturdays, which the Worldwide Church of God kept as the Sabbath. And all was fine until TWA transferred him to a new position that required daytime shift on Saturday. When he got transferred to the new position, he lost his seniority, and so they forced him to start working on Saturdays, which he refused. And he said, look, just transfer me back to my old job. And they said, sorry, that job's not available anymore. And he said, well, why can't I just work 4 days a week? And they said, nope, we need you here 5 days a week. And so he said, well, can you pay someone overtime to cover me, you know, on the few Saturdays that you need me? And they refused to do that. And so they ultimately discharged him for refusing to work on Saturdays. Now, the Eighth Circuit, so you have the trial court level, and then after the trial court, you have the circuit court. And after the circuit court, you have the Supreme Court. Well, the trial court sided with TWA, and so Mr. Hardison appealed. And the Eighth Circuit sided with Mr. Hardison and said that, look, TWA, they could have done something and accommodated him without undue hardship on the business. But TWA, they weren't satisfied with that. They didn't want to accommodate him. So they appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And what they claimed was that this was a violation of the Establishment Clause. That Title VII, by the government passing Title VII and forcing me, the employer, to prefer someone's religion was unconstitutional because it prefers a religion and it's requiring us, an employer, to favor religion. And so they were arguing that the Civil Rights Act, as applied to religion, was unconstitutional. And so this is what the attorneys all briefed the Supreme Court on, was the constitutionality of the Civil Rights Act as related to religion. Now, we know that the Constitution, the First Amendment, says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And so that's the two religion clauses of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And so they were saying this is a violation of the Establishment Clause. Congress passed a law making us honor this man's religion, and so court, you should throw it out. And so you have to remember, when this case came up to the Supreme Court in the 70s, it was during this era in the 60s and 70s that the Supreme Court was really concerned about Establishment Clause violations. It had only recently started applying the Establishment Clause to the states. Remember, when our Constitution was first passed, it only applied to the federal government. And so there were many states that mandated either certain religions or religious tests for office. All the way up until, the 1830s and even later than that. And so states were allowed to tread on your religious rights unless there was something in the state's constitution that kept them from doing so. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War and ratified in 1868 that the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution applied to the states. But even then, the Supreme Court refused to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. It wasn't until around the 1940s, 1947, I believe it was, in the Everson versus Board of Education case, that the Supreme Court applied the First Amendment to the states. And so even though we had the 14th Amendment ratified in 1868, it took the court, six or seven decades to actually apply that to the states. And I think that's because you have life tenure at the Supreme Court, and you had a lot of Supreme Court justices that were sympathetic to states' rights. And so they were refusing to apply the Bill of Rights to the states, even though we had passed the 14th Amendment. So there's a little background there. And so we had all these cases coming during this kind of awakening moment that the Establishment Clause applies to the states. You had them taking down Maryland's requirement that a candidate for public office had to declare a belief in God in order to be in public office. They said that's a violation of the Establishment Clause. You had the Bible readings in schools. You had reciting the Lord's Prayer in schools. You had the daily prayer in schools. And then you had the Lemon case, which kind of established the test for what is a violation of the Establishment Clause. There were Pennsylvania had a law reimbursing religious schools with state funds for textbooks and teacher salaries. And so you had all these Establishment Clause issues coming up during this time in front of the Supreme Court. And so TWA thought, they were on pretty good ground that this was going to be an Establishment Clause violation. And so so this went up to the Supreme Court. And it's interesting, if you look at the Supreme Court's majority opinion, even though both parties briefed the court, the main issue was on whether or not this violated the Establishment Clause, The Supreme Court, at least the majority opinion, completely kind of ignores it, doesn't even talk about it. And instead, they said in their holding, they said to require TWA to bear more than a de minimis cost in order to give Hardison Saturdays off is an undue hardship. And so what the court said was that basically Congress passed a law that businesses have to accommodate employees' religious rights unless it would be an undue hardship. And so then the Supreme Court said undue hardship equals de minimis costs, or something more than a de minimis cost. Now, has anyone here ever had a hardship? Anyone here? I imagine we've all had a hardship. Would you describe your hardship as trifling or insignificant? Well, if you look up Black's Law Dictionary, this is the legal dictionary that the judges and attorneys use, de minimis means trifling, negligible, so insignificant that a court may overlook it in deciding an issue or case. This is straight from Black's Law Dictionary. And so the court was basically saying that an employer can come up with any excuse not to accommodate someone's religious observance, and then they would be out of having to accommodate. And so, obviously, hardship doesn't mean trifling or negligible. But did Congress pass a law that just said hardship? Or did it say undue hardship? It said undue hardship, right? So if a hardship is bad, right? Hardships are bad. What about an undue hardship? Undue hardship means excessive or exceeding, right? Exceeding hardship. And so it's a very odd ruling there that doesn't at all capture the meaning of what Congress meant. You have trivial over here, right? And you have undue way over here. And somewhere in the middle, there's hardship, right? And so what Congress passed was that employers would have to endure hardship, but not to the point that it's undue. But what the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to define undue hardship as anything that's just more than something trivial. And so it sided with TWA. And unfortunately, since the 1970s, we've had to deal with this in trying to get accommodations under federal law. And so it's been very difficult for Adventists, not just Adventists, people of all faiths, to get accommodations in the workplace because of this skewed definition that the court gave to Congress's statute. And so this brings us to the Groff case. And so with the Groff case, our specific question to the court was, does undue hardship really mean de minimis, or is it something else? Now, we had already had three Supreme Court justices that had said, hey, we need to relook at the TWA, then the Hardison case, because, you know, it's not adding up there. And so we already knew that three justices were wanting to relook at the case. You need four for them to accept a case. And so we felt like we had a pretty good shot. It's interesting, though, a few years before we requested cert in our case, the Adventist Church had a case against Walgreens. Patterson, Seventh-day Adventist man, worked for Walgreens, and Walgreens refused to accommodate his Sabbath, and so the Adventist Church took the case up to the Supreme Court, but they denied cert. Said, no, this isn't the right case to relook at Hardison. And so they refused to do that. But then we have our Sunday Keeper case, and I don't know, maybe it's just coincidence, but the Supreme Court says, yeah, we'll look at that case. And so we're thankful that the court did grant cert in our case to relook at this language. And so we ended up briefing the court last fall and winter to get cert, and then cert was granted on January 13 of this year. I remember that because that was my birthday, and I was like, man, I didn't know the court knew it was my birthday. And so I was, had a very nice birthday that year. And so then we were off to the races, drafting the brief to the court for why it should overturn Hardison and rule that undue hardship really is what it means, undue hardship. An employer has to accommodate you unless it would be an undue hardship. And not only that, one of the things the post office argued that the lower court ruled on was that some of his co-workers complained. And so, you know, that's a hardship on the business because you have disgruntled employees. And so that's what they were claiming. Now, there was actually no co-worker testimony that came out in the case, but it was the supervisor saying that, you know, people were complaining to him that this guy was having off on Sundays. And so anyways, that was another issue. We said, can a business use co-worker complaints to satisfy undue hardship? And so that's very concerning, right? Because it basically leaves our rights up to a heckler's vote, right? People don't like you. Maybe they don't like your religion. They don't like that you keep the Sabbath, and they don't, or whatever it is, you know, and they start complaining. Maybe they don't like that you're not vaccinated or, you know, whatever the case may be, and they start complaining. Then the employer can say, well, it's causing, you know, causing disgruntled employees and disrupting the workplace, and so we can't accommodate. And so we asked the court to weigh in on that issue as well. And so the court accepted both of our issues. They didn't have to. Thankfully, they did. And so on April 18 of this year, we were up there in Washington, D.C., and got to go in front of the United States Supreme Court for the first time. And maybe the last, I don't know. We have a lot of religious liberty issues coming ahead, so whatever God has in mind. But it was a very interesting experience. I've never been in such a high security facility or structured situation. There was a long line of people waiting. A friend of mine wanted to go in and hear oral argument. Anybody can go in and hear, but they only have so many seats. They have about 50 seats. Well, it depends on how popular it is, because they have some reserved for the press and other things. And so, but the public can go. And a friend of mine, he went and stood in line and got there at midnight to stand in line to go hear the case. And he was number 42 in line. There were 41 people standing in front of him, and they ended up only having 44 seats available, and so he barely ended up getting in the next morning to hear the oral argument. And so you arrive to the court, you go in the bottom side, and it's a magnificent structure, all made of marble, and, you know, giant marble columns. And you go in, and it's a very impressive courtroom. And the justices, their bench is up high like this, sitting there, you know, looking down on everyone. And the ceiling's, I don't know, 30, 40 feet high, just lined with marble buildings. And I was walking in, another attorney on a different case behind me. I heard him whisper under his breath that he's shaking in his boots. And I was thinking to myself, well, if you're shaking in your boots in this court, imagine the heavenly court, right? You know, you read Daniel, and that one's got streams of fire, not pillars of marble, right? And but we're thankful that we have an advocate there, so we don't have to be shaking in our boots. Now, thankfully, I wasn't the one arguing this case, so I didn't have to be shaking in my boots. But I got to sit there right in front of Amy Coney Barrett and hear the oral argument. And we noticed during oral argument that the court was very concerned about overturning prior precedent, something in the law called stare decisis, where the court gives great weight and deference to prior court decisions because they don't just want to be like a reed shaking in the wind. And I think the court is especially concerned about this, you know, given all the flack it received after overturning Roe versus Wade. And so we kind of had that strike against us. It was interesting because we're suing, the post office, and they're represented by the Solicitor General's Office of the United States of America. And the Solicitor General's Office had argued in a brief in the Patterson case. Remember, that was the case a few years earlier that the Adventist Church tried to bring on the same issue. The Solicitor General's Office had said, yeah, you should, you know, take this case and overrule Hardison. And so here we are a few years later, and now the Solicitor General is representing the employer who's on the other side. So now they're like, well, we know we said that back then, but, you know, maybe we shouldn't quite overturn Hardison, maybe we can find a middle ground. And so, they were having to kind of backtrack on their statement. And so we were pushing for them to overturn Hardison, and the court ended up not doing that, but it did something even better in hindsight, is that it changed the law, but it kept Hardison in place. So it gave a unanimous opinion, and it said the Supreme Court it held that employer must show that the burden of granting an accommodation will result in substantial increased costs in relation to the conduct of its particular business. And so it found in a footnote in the Hardison case, footnote 14, where the justices in that case back in the 70s had said TWA had done all that it could due to accommodate Hardison's religious beliefs without either incurring substantial costs or violating the seniority rights of other employees. And so what the Supreme Court said was, they said that, the law was always substantial costs. So that de minimis language in Hardison, courts have just been misinterpreting that. And so what the law is that a employer has to accommodate unless it would be a substantial cost on the business, and then it is excused from accommodating. And so it didn't overturn Hardison. But that actually, in hindsight, ended up being a blessing, because then I can argue that the law, as the Supreme Court said, was always substantial cost. So all of my cases I have right now against all of these employers that are saying we don't have to accommodate you because it would be more than de minimis cost, or we don't have to accommodate your religious request not to be vaccinated because it would be more than a de minimis cost on us or impact the health and safety of the environment, which is what employers are arguing. They could have said, well, that was the law then when we made the decision, right? But now they can't say that because the Supreme Court said this was always the law. And so now employers have to show that it would be a substantial cost on the business, and that gets them out of accommodating. And so here's what the law is now. So when you have a religious accommodation case, you have to prove, the employee, that you have a bona fide religious belief that conflicted with a job requirement. The need to accommodate the conflict was a motivating factor in the employer's decision. And the employer took an adverse action against you. Then after that, the burden shifts to the employer, and they have to show that they either offered a reasonable accommodation or the burden of granting an accommodation would result in substantial increased costs in relation to the conduct of its business. And so this is the new rubric that we are in. And so this is great for Seventh-day Adventists, but not just for Groff, great for him, but for us. and for people of all faiths, because now employers have to show that it would be a substantial cost on them to accommodate. And what's great is that we're seeing this case, even though it's only been, what, less than two months, June, July, August, yeah. It's only been 2 months, and I'm seeing this come up in a lot of cases. I want to show you a case here that was recently decided in California. This was Randy Payne versus the St. Charles Health System. And there, Randy was the facility supervisor at this hospital in Oregon, and he was terminated after he submitted a religious exemption request to the COVID vaccine, and HR denied it and said, you know, it would be more than a de minimis burden on the hospital to accommodate the religious belief. And so he filed a lawsuit, and the hospital filed a motion to dismiss and claimed that the plaintiff, Mr. Payne, to wear an N95 mask and frequently test would have posed more than a de minimis hardship as a matter of law. So this was their motion that they filed before the Groff decision came out. And so the plaintiff in this case, he was willing to wear a mask and test frequently, but they said, no, you have to get you have to get vaccinated or you lose your job. And so they filed this motion to dismiss before the Groff case was decided. But then the court ruled after the Groff case was decided and said, whoops, wrong standard. And so they said, applying the standard for Title VII claims for religious accommodation as articulated in Groff, the court disagrees. Here, there is nothing in the record thus far to show that allowing plaintiff to adhere to his proposed accommodations, wearing an N95 mask and antibody testing, while continuing to work as a facility's supervisor, would constitute an undue hardship by resulting in substantial increased costs in relation to the conduct of defendant's business. And so you're already seeing how this case is helping advance religious liberty. And not just in COVID cases. And actually, I have a case I'm handling right now for a gentleman. He was an arborist, and all he did was go around, work for the city, and look at trees all day. And they refused to accommodate him, even though he didn't have interaction really with other people. And now they came to us after the Groff ruling. I wrote them a nice letter about the ruling in the case, and they've come back and offered us a six-figure settlement. And so I've had another case that settled recently in six figures, a COVID case, because this Groff case, doesn't just help Sabbath observers, but it helps people with all different religious liberty issues. And we're also seeing, I'm starting to get clients calling me about LGBT gender issues. I had a client recently who was fired because he refused to use the preferred pronoun of his coworker. That upset his coworker, and so the employer fired my client because he wouldn't use his preferred pronoun. Now, my client offered to call the person by their last name, right? You know, what's wrong with that? You would call, you know, you can call me Cherny, or, you know, it's gender neutral. It's just their last name. That seems like a reasonable accommodation. And I think because of the Groff case, I think we have a pretty good case, right? You know, lots of people call people by their last name. And then it's not a violation of his belief, and it shouldn't offend that person, even though it does. The employer refused to do that and said, no, that's still offensive. So somehow calling you by your last name is offensive. I don't know. You know, I think because of the Groff decision, we have a pretty strong case there. And so this case, even though we're seeing religious liberty being undermined in other areas, this case is going to help us in the exercise of our religious beliefs, not just in the Sabbath area, like with Mr. Groff, but in all other areas that we practice. And so I thank you guys for your time. Please keep me in prayer, and keep our judges in prayer. As they make these decisions, they need prayer as well. And so I don't know, are we doing questions or no questions? But I'll be around. You can come and talk to me if you have any questions. Thank you again.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. Free listing of this message and over 7,000 other presentations by more than 100 speakers on 50 different topics is now available on our American Christian Ministries mobile app for Android and Apple devices, and on our secure website, or call 800-233-4450. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help to prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.